Back together, you and I, for a midweek Wednesday edition, January 19th, 2022, on Connecticut Today. We had some thoughts on Bob Stefanowski officially entering the 2022 race for governor. And will it be Stefanowski Lamont round two? Mortgage lender John DiIorio joined us again to update his ongoing battle with the State Department of Banking. And we also provided live coverage of a portion of President Joe Biden's news conference. Now, earlier today, right here at Connoisseur Media, down the hall from where I am right now, our friends Chaz and AJ from Chaz and AJ in the Morning at 99.1 PLR. They spoke to Mr. Stefanowski, and he made the announcement official on that show right here in one of our great Connoisseur Media stations.
Yeah, I remember when Reagan was running against Carter, and he used the phrase, "Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?" And I think if you were to ask most of your voters or most of your listeners right now, Chaz, they would say that they're not. I mean, we've got the second highest taxes in the entire country. We've got the highest utility bills. Connecticut has the highest utility bills in the continental U.S. Last year was one of the most violent years we've had in Connecticut in 10 years. People are tired. They're worn out. They want change. Chaz, I've got a plan to fix it. I've got the leadership. I've got the commitment to do it. And this is exactly what we're going to do. We're going to turn around this state.
All right. So there you go. And that was, again, Bob Stefanowski on with our friends Chaz and AJ at 99.1 PLR earlier today, making the announcement and outlining the two things he is going to focus on. He's going to focus on dollar and cents issues, economic issues, and also safety. And I have said this over and over again. And, of course, the phone lines are open. What do you think of this whole thing? Now, again, we have several months of this to play out. We don't know precisely what Themis Claridis is doing here. You don't know if the former state House Republican leader, the minority leader, she is, you know, spending money. And you don't know whether, you know, she's going to directly challenge Bob Stefanowski or not at a convention or with delegates. You don't know whether that's a certainty. But, you know, as you look at the early parts of this campaign, one thing, and I was chatting with people about this over the past couple of weeks, you know, Bob Stefanowski is right. Connecticut is expensive to live in. I mean, it's to the point of what services we get, it is ridiculously expensive to live in. I mean, he's right when he says, you know, our utility costs are crazy. The electricity prices we pay are crazy. The gasoline prices, the gas tax, as I've talked about on this show numerous times, nickel and diming all these fees, you know, an environmental fee for this, a recycling fee for that. And again, you know, our friends at the Yankee Institute have shown over the past few months that a lot of that money never goes to what it's supposed to go for. And this thought about putting more money on gasoline with TCI and all these state fees. And yes, Bob Stefanowski is, to a great part, a great point. He is spot on that. It is expensive to live in this state. It is. And some people choose to leave, especially when they get to about retirement age or later. I know people that have done that because for them, money is a big thing. I get that. I understand that. And there are people that, again, I know around my same age, a little older, a little less, who, you know, are retiring or still working and say, you know what, I'm going to stay here. I like it here. It's expensive, but the kids are out of the house. I have the money I need. I have a retirement plan set up. So I enjoy the, you know, the Four Seasons and all that. So, again, that is a viable point in a campaign. It is. The expenses are viable to that. We understand that. It's not that anyone doesn't understand that. However, I think, and this is just me, this is your friendly little neighborhood talk show host talking here at, you know, 2:14 on a Wednesday, middle of the week Wednesday. And I'm glad he did, however, mention the other part of this. We had Len Fasano on the other day who co-wrote that op-ed with Bob Stefanowski in the Hearst, Connecticut papers. I think the more, what word can I use? The more powerful issue here. This is just me. I'm not saying expenses aren't important. I'm not saying that what people have to put out of their pockets, I'm not saying that's not important. But, man, I'm telling you, the issue of crime, the issue of public safety, that is the clear, to me anyway, that's got to be, and he said it would be, and I congratulate him for that. Because the lunacy we're seeing now, and I've been saying this over and over for weeks, and I'm glad the Republicans apparently are going to latch on to it. The lunacy we're seeing now with the apparent reluctance of the Democratic majority in Hartford to really do anything about it. You know, they always point to the numbers, and they'll always be pointing to this and that. But the bottom line is, every single day I come on this show, every single day I come on this show, virtually, there's something else with a juvenile or two juveniles, you know, sticking up people at knife point. What about those two stories I read for the past couple of days, the other one yesterday in Southington, where you had two juveniles, you know, rob a liquor store in a stolen car, in a car that came from Torrington down to Southington, rob the liquor store, hit vehicles, and then the car ends up on the front stoop of this woman. And guess what? They're released to their parents. They're released to their parents. So, Mr. Stefanowski, I know your campaign apparatus is listening. But I got to tell you, public safety, public safety, public safety, I'm telling you. Now, already, Nancy DiNardo, what a surprise, Democratic Party. And what is she trying to do? Link Bob Stefanowski with Trump. Link him with Trump. Trump this and Trump that. Now, you know what? I'm telling you what the response to that should be from the candidate and maybe from his campaign apparatus. You know what they should say? Nancy, you know what? You've got Trump derangement syndrome. I'm worried about people getting carjacked and knifed in Connecticut. Why does your party consistently say there's nothing to worry about when cars, according to police around the state, are being consistently stolen by multi-time juveniles, multi-offenders? So if you want to talk to Trump and talk about Trump, that's fine, because that's all they have now. That's all the Democratic Party has now. Trump, 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 Trump with a side of Trump and Trump for dessert. So bravo to Bob Stefanowski for getting in. Is he going to win? I have no idea. I don't know. I don't bet. I have no idea. But already we're seeing the first response. I'm telling you, the first response from Democrats, just like Pavlov's dog, get that salivary reflex. Oh, the bell rang. Trump, Trump, Trump. Going to follow up right now on a story, and a gentleman who was on with me, I think it was pre-COVID, I know that, so it must have been a little over 2 years ago. We spoke to the gentleman who joins us right now, John DiIorio, and at the time, and gosh, I thought this would be settled, but here in the state of Connecticut, I guess not. John's case and his involvement with his company, a mortgage company, it was battling the state and the state banking department. This thing has gone to the state Supreme Court now. It's getting additional media attention because it's still going. And this could be an example, folks, people, if the state wants to come after you, even if they may be in the wrong, it's awful tough for the state to sit back and be adults and say, okay, maybe we got this wrong. And we welcome back a gentleman who is still battling the state banking department after years. John DiIorio is with us. Hey, John, it's Paul. Good to speak with you again. How are you?
Good morning, Paul. Good afternoon, I guess. I'm doing fine, thank you. How are you?
Good. And you know, when I saw Dan Hard's story here, though, the link that you sent me from the Connecticut Post, my first reaction, Dan, no offense, was this is still going. And I was shocked to read this. Let's reset this for the audience because it's been a while, John, since you were on with me. You were running a mortgage company, First Alliance Lending, LLC. You employed almost 180 people. You were writing mortgages, as many other companies do. And then what happened? You get a call or a visit from the state years ago, and take us through this.
Yes. So in May of 2018, the Department of Banking, which was located less than a mile away from First Alliance Lending, showed up for a surprise exam It was the first time they had examined us in a decade, mostly because of the statistical analysis used to determine risk that a lender poses to the public. Our statistical analysis showed that we were very low risk to the public, mm-hmm. which kind of put us down on their examination priority list. But they came in and basically decided that we had people working for the company. They were called home loan coordinators, often referred to in the industry as loan officer assistants, mm-hmm. Who would take an intake from a consumer and pass that information on to a licensed mortgage loan originator.
Sure.
And the department decided that those people should have also been licensed. And we got pretty close to signing a consent order in September of 2018. But at the advice of counsel, we did not sign it because it contained a gag order that prevented us from defending our position with other regulatory bodies.
Interesting. And so your lawyer tells you, hey, I found this in there. If you sign this, this could come back to bite you later on. Is that the message?
Well, the allegations that they were making were pretty serious allegations. Mm-hmm. And the law in question is called a model state law. So Connecticut's not the only one who has that same language. So I think what our lawyers were thinking and what I was thinking as CEO of the company was we need to be able to tell other regulators what our position is.
Sure.
Right? Because once this is out there, mm-hmm. you're open to attack from anywhere. And the gag order was specific that we were not allowed to refute the allegations in regulatory filings. It was that specific. And the banking department refused to take that language out, and chaos ensued and has ensued now for almost 4 years.
All right, John, hang on. We'll get to the chaos part of this and the fact that there are people still saying now, hey, it's time to, you know, to settle this. And there are some people in the media saying, hey, maybe the state should back off on this a little bit. John DiIorio is the guest. Hang on, John Moore with you. First Traffic and Weather Together right here on WICC. And after years and years, about 4 years now, the gentleman joining us, who joined us about this a couple of years back, is still battling the state of Connecticut here in a situation that kind of illustrates, folks, that, you know, when you try to battle the state capitol or town hall or city hall, and you know, if they have all the resources and have the money and have armies of lawyers, they can make life very tough for you. John DiIorio is with us. John at one time ran a company, First Alliance Lending, almost 180 employees, got into a row with the state that goes back to a 2009 law regarding mortgage writing and who has to take in the actual information and write the mortgage. So, John, pick it up from where, you know, your attorneys say, hey, wait a minute, this gag order in this agreement, the state wants us to sign to make this all go away. This is not good for you. So what happens there?
Yeah, we went back to them and said, you know, we need this gag order taken out. They basically said, well, that's our final offer. And we said, okay, well, then I guess we're going to go through the administrative process. And they took very, very aggressive actions to destabilize the company. Things like sending state marshals onto the company's into the company's call center and serving employees for deposition in front of each other. Opening those depositions with statements like, we think that you should understand that the interests of yourself and the interests of your employer may not be aligned. Referring the matter out to a bunch of other states to come in and examine our practices.
Now, John, had you gotten any complaints or concerns from other states, or is it just Connecticut that was making all this happen?
Oh, this was all Connecticut. Connecticut is the only state that has taken any enforcement action against First Alliance, despite the fact that many, many of them, 19 to be exact, looked. And, you know, like I said, it's model state legislation. The Connecticut legislation is not unique. And every state that shares the model state language found us compliant.
So this is happening under the State Banking Commission, led by Commissioner George Perez at the time, and some people may recognize that name. He's been for years a large name in politics and Democratic politics around the state, largely around the New Haven area. Now, somebody, you know, who is listening to us, you know, talk about this, you know, may think, John, they may say, well, okay, there's got to be something going on. Why does Perez have it in for you? Why does the state banking department have it in for you? Is that what you felt? Did you ever understand or why there's a perception maybe of you being targeted here?
You know, I don't want to use the word targeted. I don't believe that at the beginning of this process, First Alliance was targeted. I think that I think what happened, and, you know, if you have the depth of understanding of the record that I do, when it became clear that Connecticut was wrong and First Alliance was correct, you know, there had already been a lot of press coverage.
Sure.
And I think that the fact that First Alliance sought due process instead of just caving and then took the extra step of publicly declaring their innocence and defending them publicly, it clearly, according to people who are speaking on behalf of the banking department in public, it made them, quote unquote, very angry. And once that happened, it just escalated to a whole nother level where it went from your typical enforcement action to something very atypical. I think the most important fact for everyone to understand is Connecticut's interpretation of this law is not public. They've never issued a regulation clarifying their very unique position. They've never provided any public notice to the industry that they have this very unique interpretation. And the moment their interpretation became clear to First Alliance, we changed our business practices to comply. So someone who's a bit steeped in the world of regulation, the goal of regulation, especially in a case like First Alliance's, where there is just zero consumer harm, this is not about a company who is out inflicting harm on people. Mm-hmm. This is about a company and the agency having a different interpretation. The goal should be to achieve compliance. And First Alliance supports that. I mean, you want equal rules for everyone. You want compliance. And as soon as First Alliance understood their interpretation, we complied. And that just wasn't good enough.
And then
when we wouldn't sign the consent order and we went on the radio to defend our position, it just escalated into, quite frankly, something we never anticipated and something we had never seen before.
Now, you did have an online hearing, John, a short time ago with Superior Court Judge John Cordani, and it does. The impression I get from reading this story, John, is the fact that the court kind of wants everybody to act like adults here and just settle this thing without it still being out of control here. I mean, is that what do you think the judge is trying to see happen here?
Honestly, I don't want to put words or thoughts into any judge's mind. I think the judge did two things in response to the hearing. One was he admitted a bunch of evidence into the record that the banking department had previously withheld from the record, and sent it back to them to evaluate that information, determine whether or not they want to change, alter their decision or not. The other thing he did was stay the matter until that process is complete. And he left the second motion kind of out there until that happens. And the second motion is about a former Connecticut banking department lawyer who now is in private practice, who was giving a presentation at the Mortgage Bankers Association about regulation, and was using the First Alliance case as an example.
Wow.
And was quoting the regulator and going in depth about the insightful things that the regulator said to her about how First Alliance's actions and defenses made them very angry. And then you combine that with the fact that Commissioner Perez, in testimony before the banking committee, the Connecticut General Assembly's banking committee, in March of 2021, indicated that, you know, if you make your regulator, I'm not going to use his language.
Okay, no, I get it. I got it. Yeah.
If you make your regulator get angry, if you make your regulator angry, then they're going to get even with you. And I think that the judge looked at those two things, and he's going to wait to see what the commissioner does in terms of the remand and whether or not they modify their decision. And then when that process is over, First Alliance will do something called reclaiming the motion, and the judge will decide whether or not we get to take some depositions or not.
Wow.
That's what he did.
Yeah.
So I appreciate the people trying to forecast or think about what he did, but I think if you just look at the facts, he admitted a bunch of evidence, sent it back to the department for reevaluation, and is waiting on the motion to depose other individuals until he sees that result.
Well, John, I give you credit for sticking this out. I've seen this over the years happen to other people with other departments in the state, and the state departments and other people raised the white flag and said, "That's it, I'm out of here. I can't take this anymore." So, good luck. Keep me and the audience here up to date on what's going on. John DiIorio, the founder and CEO of First Alliance Lending, still in a protracted battle with the state banking department after a good 3 or 4 years. John, good to speak with you again. Take care and keep me up to date. Okay.
I will do, Paul. I hope you have a great afternoon.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
But it's also been a year of enormous progress. We went from 2 million people being vaccinated at the moment I was sworn in to 210 million Americans being fully vaccinated today. We created 6 million new jobs, more jobs in 1 year than any time before. The unemployment rate dropped to 3.9%. Child poverty dropped by nearly 40%, the biggest drop ever in American history. New business applications grew by 30%, the biggest increase ever. And for the first time in a long time, this country's working people actually got a raise. People, the bottom 40%, saw their income go up the most of all that got a raise. We cut health insurance premiums for millions of American families, and we just made surprise medical bills illegal in this country. You know those bills you get that you don't expect of $2,000 to $5,000 from the hospital beyond what you thought you were going to have to owe because of the consultation you weren't told was going to cost that much? No more. They're now illegal. Thanks to the American Rescue Plan and other actions we've taken, we've seen record job creation, record economic growth in the past year. Now, thanks to the bipartisan infrastructure bill, we're about to make a record investment in rebuilding America to take us to be the number one best infrastructure in the world. Well, now we're way below that. We'll be creating better jobs for millions of people, modernizing our roads, our bridges, our highways, our ports, our airports, everything from making clean water, removing lead pipes, that every American can turn on a faucet and drink clean water, urban and rural and suburban communities. It's going to make affordable high-speed internet available to every American in urban, rural, and suburban areas. We've never done that before. Now we are. We're in the process of getting that done. Still, for all this progress, I know there's a lot of frustration and fatigue in this country. And we know why. COVID-19. Omicron has now been challenging us in a way that it's the new enemy. But while it's cause for concern, it's not cause for panic. We've been doing everything we can, learning and adapting as fast as we can, and preparing for a future beyond the pandemic. All I know that after almost 2 years of physical, emotional, and psychological weight of this pandemic and the impact it's had on everyone, for many of us, it's been too much to bear. We're in a very different place now, though. We have the tools. Vaccines, boosters, masks, tests, pills to save lives and keep businesses and schools open. 75% of adults are fully vaccinated. We've gone from 90 million adults with no shots in arms last summer and down to 35 million with no shots as of today. And we're adding about 9 million more vaccinations each week. We're going to stick with our vaccination efforts because vaccinations work. So get vaccinated, please, and get your booster. Look, we're also increasing testing. Should we have done more testing earlier? Yes, but we're doing more now. We've gone from zero at-home tests a year ago to 375 million tests on the market in just this month. If you buy a test at a store, your insurance will reimburse you. On top of that, we're making 1 billion at-home tests available for you to order and be delivered to your home for free. Just visit covidtest.gov to know how to get that free test kit to your home. In addition, there are 20,000 sites where you can get tested in person for free now. And now we have more treatments that people can, keep people out of the hospital than any other point in the pandemic, including life-saving antiviral pills. We purchased 20 million of these new Pfizer pills, more than any country in the world. And the bottom line on COVID-19 is that we're in a better place than we've been and have been thus far, clearly better than a year ago. We're not going back to lockdowns. We're not going back to closing schools. Schools should stay open. Because the American Rescue Plan, we provided to states $130 billion to keep our students and educators safe and schools open. Funding for ventilation systems in the schools, social distancing, hygiene for classrooms and the school buses. In addition, we've added another $10 billion for COVID-19 tests to be able to be administered at schools. And many states and school districts have spent this money very well. Unfortunately, some haven't. I encourage the states and school districts that use the funding to protect our children and keep our schools open. Use it. The COVID-19 is not going to give up and accept things. It's just not going to go away immediately. But I'm not going to give up and accept things as they are now. Some people may call what's happening now the new normal. I call it a job not yet finished. It will get better. We're moving toward a time when COVID-19 won't disrupt our daily lives, where COVID-19 won't be a crisis, but something to protect against and a threat. Look, we're not there yet, but we will get there. Now, the second challenge we're facing are prices. COVID-19 has created a lot of economic complications, including rapid price increases across the world economy. People see it at the gas pumps, the grocery stores, and elsewhere. So here's what we're going to do. A critical job in making sure that the elevated prices don't become entrenched rests with the Federal Reserve, which has a dual mandate, full employment and stable prices. The Federal Reserve provided extraordinary support during the crisis for the previous year and a half. Given the strength of our economy and the pace of recent price increases, it's appropriate, as the Federal Chairman Powell has indicated, to recalibrate the support that is now necessary. I respect the Fed's independence, and I've nominated five superb individuals to serve on the Federal Board of Governors, men and women from a variety of ideological perspectives. They're eminently qualified, historically diverse, and have earned bipartisan praise. I call on the United States Senate to confirm them without any further delay. And here at the White House, and for my friends in Congress, the best thing to tackle high prices is a more productive economy with greater capacity to deliver goods and services to the American people. And a growing economy where folks have more choices and more small businesses compete and where more goods can get to market faster and cheaper. I've laid out a three-part plan to do just that. First, fix the supply chain. COVID-19 has had a global impact on the economy. When a factory shuts down in one part of the world, shipments to shops and homes and businesses all over the world are disrupted. COVID-19 has compounded that many times over. A couple of months ago, in this very room we heard dire warnings about how the supply chain problems could create a real crisis around the holidays. So we acted. We brought together business and labor, and that much-predicted crisis did not occur. 99% of the packages were delivered on time, and shelves were stocked. And notwithstanding the recent storms that have impacted many parts of our country, the share of goods in stock at stores is 89% now, which has barely changed from the 91% before the pandemic. I often see empty shelves being shown on television. 89% are full, which is only a few points below what it was before the pandemic. But our work's not done. My infrastructure law will supercharge your effort upgrading everything from roads and bridges to ports and airports, railways and transit, to make the economy move faster and reduce prices for families. Second thing, my Build Back Better plan will address the biggest cost of working families face every day. No other plan will do more to lower the cost for American families. It cuts the cost for childcare. Many families, including the people sitting in this room, if they have children and they're working full-time, many families pay up to $14,000 a year for childcare in big cities, less than that in smaller ones. My plan cuts that in half. That will not only be a game changer for so many families' budgets, but it will mean so much for the nearly 2 million women who've left the workforce during the pandemic because of things like childcare. My Build Back Better plan cuts the price of prescription drugs, so insulin, that today costs some people as much as $1,000 a month, will cost no more than $35 a month. It cuts the cost of elder care. It lowers energy costs. And it will do all this without raising a single penny in taxes on people making under $400,000 a year or raising the deficit. In fact, my plan cuts the deficit and it boosts the economy by getting more people into the workforce. That's why 17 Nobel Prize winners for economics say it will ease long-term inflationary pressure. The bottom line: if price increases are what you're worried about, the best answer is my Build Back Better plan. Third thing we're going to do, promote competition. Look, in too many industries, a handful of giant companies dominate the market in sectors like meat processing, railroad, shipping, and other areas. This isn't a new issue. It's not been the reason we've had high inflation today. It's not the only reason. It's been happening for a decade. But over time, it has reduced competition, squeezed out small businesses and farmers, ranchers, and increased the price for consumers. We end up with an industry like the meat processing industry, where four big companies dominate the markets, pay ranchers less for their cattle they grow, charge consumers more for beef, hamburger meat, whatever they're buying. Prices are up. Look, I'm a capitalist, but capitalism without competition is not capitalism. It's exploitation. So I signed an executive order to tackle unfair competition in our economy, and we're going to continue to enforce it, along with working with Congress where we can. I'll close with this. We have faced some of the biggest challenges that we've ever faced in this country these past few years. Challenges to our public health, challenges to our economy. But we're getting through it. And not only are we getting through it, we're laying the foundation for a future where America wins the 21st century by creating jobs at a record pace. Now we need to get inflation under control. We have developed an extraordinarily effective booster shots and antiviral pills. Now we need to finish the job to get COVID-19 under control. I've long said, it's never been a good bet to bet against the American people or America. I believe that more than ever today. We've seen the grit and determination of the American people this past year. But the best days of this country are still ahead of us, not behind us. I'm happy to take questions. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. President. I know some of my colleagues will get into some specific issues, but I wanted to zoom out on your first year in office. Inflation is up. Your signature domestic legislation is stalled in Congress. In a few hours from now, the Senate, an effort in the Senate to deal with voting rights and voting reform legislation is going to fail. COVID-19 is still taking the lives of 1,500 Americans every day. And the nation's divisions are just as raw as they were a year ago. Did you overpromise to the American public what you could achieve in your first year in office? And how do you plan to course correct going forward?
Why are you such an optimist? Look, I didn't overpromise. And what I have probably outperformed what anybody thought would happen. The fact of the matter is that we're in a situation where we have made enormous progress. You mentioned the number of deaths from COVID. Well, it was three times that not long ago. It's coming down. Everything's changing. It's getting better. Look, I didn't overpromise, but I think if you take a look at what we've been able to do, you'd have to acknowledge we made enormous progress. But one of the things that I think is something that one thing I haven't been able to do so far is get my Republican friends to get in the game of making things better in this country. For example, I was reading the other day, and I wrote the quote down so I don't misquote him, a quote from Senator Sununu when he decided that he wasn't going, excuse me, Governor Sununu, when he decided he wasn't going to run for the Senate in New Hampshire. Here's what he said. They were all, for the most, quote, they were all, for the most part, content with the speed at which they weren't doing anything. It was very clear that we just had to hold the line for 2 years. Okay, so I'm just going to be a roadblock for the next 2 years? That's not what I do, Sununu said. He went on to say it bothered me that they were okay with that. Then he goes on to say, I said, okay, so we're not going to get stuff done if we win the White House back, if we win the White House back. Why didn't we do anything in 2017 and 2018? And then he said, how the Republican Sununu spoke to answer the challenge? He said, crickets, yeah, crickets. They had no answer. I did not anticipate that there'd be such a stalwart effort to make sure that the most important thing was that President Biden didn't get anything done. Think about this. What are Republicans for? What are they for? Name me one thing they're for. And so the problem here is that I think what's happens, what I have to do in the change in tactic, if you will, I have to make clear to the American people what we are for. We've passed a lot. We passed a lot of things that people don't even understand what's all that's in it, understandably. Remember when we passed the Affordable Care Act? And everybody thought that, you know, and it really was getting pummeled and beaten. And it wasn't until after out of office and that next campaign when that off-year campaign. And I went into a whole, I wasn't in office anymore, went a whole bunch of districts campaigning for Democrats and Republican districts who said they wanted to do away with health care, with Obamacare. And I started pointing out that if you did that, pre-existing conditions would no longer be covered. And they said, huh? We didn't know that. We didn't know that. And guess what? We won over 38 seats because we had explained to the people exactly what, in fact, had passed. Now, one of the things that I remember saying, and I'll end this, I remember saying to President Obama when he passed the Affordable Care Act, I said, you ought to take a victory lap. And he said, there's so many things going on, we don't have time to take a victory lap. As a consequence, no one knew what the detail of the legislation was. They don't know a lot of the detail of what we pass. So the difference is, I'm going to be out on the road a lot, making the case around the country with my colleagues who are up for re-election and others, making the case of what we did do and what we want to do, what we need to do. And so I don't think I've overpromised at all, and I'm going to stay on this track. You know, one of the things that I remember, and I'll end this, I was talking with, Jim Clyburn, who was a great help to me in the campaign in South Carolina. And Jim said, and when he endorsed me, and there was a clip on television in the last couple of days of Jim, and it said that we want to make things accessible and affordable for all Americans. That's healthcare. That's education. That's prescription drugs. That's making sure you have access to all the things that everybody else has. We can afford to do that. We can't afford not to do it. So I tell my Republican friends, here I come. This is going to be about what are you for? What are you for? And I'd lay out what we're for. Mary Bruce, ABC.
Thank you, Mr. President. You mentioned your Republican colleagues, but right now your top two legislative priorities, your social spending package and voting rights legislation, are stalled, blocked by your own party after months of negotiation. You are only guaranteed control of Washington for one more year before the midterms. Do you need to be more realistic and scale down these priorities in order to get something passed?
No, I don't think so. When you say more realistic, I think it's extremely realistic to say to people, because let me back up. You all really know the politics of this country and your networks and others. You spend a lot of time, which I'm glad you do, polling this data, determining where what the American people's attitudes are, et cetera. American people overwhelmingly agree with me on prescription drugs. They overwhelmingly agree with me on the cost of education. They overwhelmingly agree with me on early education. They overwhelmingly go on the list on child care. And so we just have to make the case of what we're for and what the other team's not for. Look, we knew all along that a lot of this was going to be an uphill fight. And one of the ways to do this is to make sure we make the contrast as clear as we can. And one of the things that I think is we're going to have to do is just make the case. I don't think there's anything unrealistic about what we're asking. I'm not asking for castles in the sky. I'm asking for practical things the American people have been asking for a long time, a long time. And I think we can get it done.
You say that you're not going to scale down any of these priorities, but so far that strategy isn't working. You haven't been able to get some of these big legislative ticket items done.
I got two real big ones done, bigger than any president has ever gotten in the first year.
But currently, Mr. President, your spending package, voting rights legislation, they're not going anywhere. So
that's true.
Is there anything that you are confident you can get signed into law before the midterm elections?
Yes, I'm confident we can get pieces, big chunks of the Build Back Better law signed into law. And I'm confident that we can take the case to the American people that the people they should be voting for who are going to oversee whether the elections, in fact, are legit or not, should not be those who are being put up by the Republicans to determine that they're going to be able to change the outcome of the election. So whether or not we can actually get election. And by the way, I haven't given up. We haven't finished the vote yet on what's going on the on voting rights and the John Lewis bill and others. But look, this is, I've been engaged a long time in public policy, and I don't know many things that have been done in one fell swoop. And so I think the most important thing to do is try to inform, not educate, inform the public of what's at stake in stark terms and let them make judgments and let them know who's for them and who's against them, who's there and who's not there, and make that the case. And that's what I'm going to be spending my time doing in this off-year election.